This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScoop, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScoop.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. My name is Peter Higgins. You can find me on Twitter at Conkers3. And I'm here with my good colleague, Peter at Wheelie Dealer on Twitter. Pete, how are you doing today, mate?
Yeah, not bad.
Are you keeping up with all the latest shenanigans regarding lockdowns in Scotland, England, Ireland, Wales and everywhere else?
Oh, but mate, I was thinking earlier, it's getting to the point I might as well just do a full lockdown of everything, because it just, you know, they keep going on about the rules being too complicated and stuff. And I mean, if anyone has any idea what the rules are, I'd be amazed. And it seems it's different everywhere you are. So, yeah, it's all quite potty, really, isn't it?
I've decided over the past couple of weeks not to listen to as much of the news, because invariably, whenever I get an understanding of what's going on regarding these various different lockdowns, and the plans that they've got, and the track and trace, and this, that, and the other, invariably it changes once I get a fuller understanding of what's going on. Yeah? And bizarrely, today, in Leicester, which I'm not part of, I'm part of Leicestershire, they're in their 100th day of lockdown, localised lockdown.
So did they have the other lockdown before, and now they've had 100 days on top?
Yes.
Good Lord.
Absolutely. And, you know, certain parts of it are doing all right. Obviously, the shops, some of the main shops are open, people going back to work, the schools are open, you know. And if there's been somebody who's like a child, for instance, at school or a college that's been found to have COVID, they're trying to keep it so that the whole school won't lock down, but that cohort or that year group may then all be kept at home for X amount of days until it, you know, there's a clearance of it or whatever. But we've not had all the schools, most of the schools in Leicestershire are open at the minute, and Leicester. For how long, I don't know. But it's quite an interesting, you know, situation that's going on.
Yeah. Well, we've had the news. I mean, we're recording this on Wednesday, the 7th of October, and it's about 6 o'clock at night. And we had the news earlier today in Scotland, where Nicola Sturgeon has sort of like, you know, well, basically sort of like closed down a lot of pubs and bars. I think it's specific to certain places like Glasgow and whatever. But I think outside, it's a little bit more relaxed for the pubs and things. But, you know, they were talking on the news, they had some restaurateur or whatever, and she was saying it's just devastating for her. You know, it's like just when they were starting to get back on their feet, it's like another blow, you know, and it's 2 weeks from Friday. And the trouble is, you know, it may not be 2 weeks. It could go on and on. Who knows?
I mean, the problem you've got, Pete, and I spoke a couple of podcasts ago about my friend that runs a chain of pubs. They were in and around Leicester and Leicestershire, and he spent an absolute fortune on these chain of pubs and getting them to a really good standard. And then he went on and invested over £1.2 million on a bowling alley. And throughout, you know, since February, the revenue streams that he was expecting for the summer and, you know, and for the coming months has all but gone, right? Mm. So he then prepares himself to open up again, which he did X amount of weeks ago. And then they were told about lockdown again in parts of Leicester. Yeah, and then on top of that, he's now been told he's got to shut at 10 o'clock on the few pubs that he's got open. So it's an ongoing thing where these hospitality businesses are stretched to the absolute max, and some of them simply will not make it into 2021. Pete, that's my concern.
No, I can't see how they will. I mean, it's just so difficult for them, and it's, you know, on with other sectors, isn't it? We all know about the culture, the theatres, blah blah blah. The other one that I thought was sort of a little bit concerning or interesting, however you want to view it, in Scotland they're talking about exams being, you know, not having exams basically, and having like an ongoing assessment, and these for I think, what did they call it, national fives or something, maybe I've got that name wrong, but it's the equivalent of GCSE in England. And of course, the implication of that is that, you know, we're talking potentially 10 months there. So we could be saying that this might drag on for at least 10 months. I mean, I hope that's not the case, but I mean, we'll all go completely potty by then.
I think there is that danger. I mean, I keep touching on the importance of wellness and well-being and the concerns I have regarding people being in isolation of various ages as well, Pete, not just the older ones, but younger
ones. Obviously, across the board.
Yeah, regarding mental health situations. And you've got a situation whereby I was speaking to some economists that, you know, mainly work around London, and they're talking about the fact that Boris is saying, oh, we'll all be back doing what we need to be doing next September. Now, you know, we're talking about another 10 months, Pete. You know, who wants 10, 11 months? Who wants to be thinking about being in various types of lockdown between now and next September? You know, that's going to drive some people to distraction. And we've only got a certain level of coherence regarding people keeping to the rules now. If we're trying to maintain that for another 10, 11 months, I can see people just going, sod it. I'm doing my thing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of heat politically. This hasn't really been stressed much, but I think it was yesterday. There was a vote on something to do with the lockdown measures, and the government appeared to win it quite easily. I think they won by, you know, loads of votes. But if you actually looked into it, loads and loads of Tory MPs abstained. So it was a bit false to say the government won it easily. In fact, they only won it because loads of MPs didn't vote against it. So it looks like there's a real rebel faction in the Tories now. It's, you know, much bigger than the 85 majority, I suspect, that are really getting to the point where they're starting to think, well, hang on, this is just doing so much damage to our economy, to our culture, to our way of life, to personal freedom, to everything. We've got to have a better way of doing things because this is just killing us, basically.
It's a really difficult one, Pete, because I suspect that, as with all these things, you know, politicians, the vast majority of them, have got other business interests. You know, this is not their full-time job, Pete, unfortunately, right?
Oh, yeah.
So they've got business interests, family business interests, etc., etc. And a lot of them are millionaires and billionaires, right? Some of them, right? Or their families are. And their businesses are being hurt as a consequence of this COVID-19 situation and the various lockdowns and people not returning to work and people not using various levels of hospitality and so on and so forth. You know, people deciding not to pay rents on buildings that, you know, because property is one of the biggest income generators in the UK. Now, some of the significant high net worth individuals... Are going to be impacting. I mean, going back to the Scotland thing, Pete...
Mm.
We've spoke about the Newcastle lockdown that they had, and that was something like 3.2 million people that were impacted by that localised lockdown in Newcastle and the surrounding areas up north, northeast, right? The rules that are going to be put in place, 6 o'clock on Friday the 25th, will apply to 3.4 million people. Yeah? So that's Edinburgh, Glasgow, Greater Glasgow, Clyde, Lanarkshire, Forth Valley, Lothian, Ayrshire, Arran, and blah, blah, blah. So that's a lot of people being told, you know, for the foreseeable, you can't go in a restaurant, you can't go in a pub. And if you do, you've got to go in this time. And there's not going to be any drink served at this one. And so what happens, Pete? What's happened in the past is people have gone, sod it, I'll have my mates round. You know?
Well, exactly, yeah.
I'll have my mates round my house. Well, how safe is that then? You're just doing something under a different guise of something else and putting yourself at risk.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that some geezer on the news was saying that when you cut out all the pubs and restaurants and things in a city like Glasgow or Edinburgh, it puts people off travelling to those places. So people who live in England who might have been thinking, oh, we'll have a weekend away in Glasgow and go and do whatever, go and see some museums or whatever's open, it's probably not much open. They're now going to be cancelling and say, well, I don't want to go up there because I won't be able to find anything to eat or, you know, it's just going to be hassle. And they might be worried about COVID as well. So, you know.
Tourism is massive in Scotland and, you know, across the UK. If you do a localised lockdown in a place of Glasgow's size and Edinburgh's size, where tourism is one of the things that generates revenue for all these different businesses, then it's going to be impacted, Pete. Absolutely. I mean, you decide, oh, crikey, there's a problem. in Edinburgh or Glasgow, if you've got an option of going to the Lake District or the Peak District or Cornwall or Devon, where are you going to go? You're going to go there instead, aren't you?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it knocks on to commercial property, as you mentioned just now. I mean, one of the things that I noticed a few days ago, LXI REIT, yeah, which, you know, it, the code is LXI, they had amazing results, like 97% rent collection or something, and well, certainly over 90%, and they've increased their dividend. And there can't be many property companies doing that. And I think they've got a mix of stuff. I think they've even got a little bit of retail, but obviously it's not much. But I think they're really well spread and stuff, you know. But I thought those were astonishing results.
Does that speak of the quality of tenants that they've got in their buildings, Pete? Are they blue chip sort of tenants rather than, you know, mum and pop
type businesses? I really don't know. I get the impression it's very diversified. There's like regional stuff, regional offices, regional warehouses, regional this, that and the other. Yeah, I think it's a real mix. But I was just like really amazed because so many property updates, results, you know, you almost don't want to read them because you
this goes back to our sort of push all the time for people to do their research, and people are going to get, you know, peed off with me saying do your own research. There are companies out there, even in the really poor sectors, that we write all these sectors off and say, you know what, ignore retail, ignore property for the time being. But within those same segments, there are gems that will thrive and will do well. So you have to dig deeper than just skim reading the RNS to see which ones are actually doing well.
Mm. No, exactly. I mean, I think another one, I mean, off the top of my head, I think this was either today or yesterday, Sirius Real Estate, which is SRE, which has property in Germany. And I think, again, it has a real diverse spread, offices, warehouses, all that kind of stuff. Their results seem pretty good, but obviously the situation there is you need to have a feel for what's happening with German property. Oh, I haven't got a clue. Yeah, I don't even know what's happening with UK property, so how would I know about German? But, you know, Germany as a country appears to be coping better with the crisis than we are. But then you could say that about any country, really, couldn't you?
I think one of the added things there, Pete, is that as a culture, they're not really great on debt and being indebted to other people. So some of these businesses will rather keep their records clean and pay their rents rather than have a little mark against their name to say, you know, these were tenants with these people before and chose not to pay their rents, and now they're coming to seek another place to rent. Should we keep them, or should we allow them to rent our property with the view that, you know, at some point or other, if they get into distress, they may not pay their rents for us? So, you know, that's something else that goes on there. But equally, they've not as had the issues of the ongoing sort of regional lockdowns over there as much as we have. The numbers probably will start creeping up again, but, you know, it depends on the quality of property that they've got and the quality of tenants that they've got. That's probably why they're getting a better return of rents being paid.
I mean, in the sort of property related as well, one of the areas I find fascinating at the moment is house builders. You know, at the moment they're really not doing anything. If anything, the charts seem to sort of tank back in March, April, then they've pretty much gone sideways, most of them, for the last 6 months or whatever it is. But you look at ones like, well, there was one today, sort of a house builder, UANC, which is Urban and Civic, and you've also got Inland, INL. You know, and on paper, when you look at the fundamentals, these things look pretty good. But of course, are they that good? If the UK economy gets worse, are they going to suffer? Or on the flip side, is government policy, which, you know, talks about levelling up and building and all the rest of it, are they actually going to benefit from that? I mean, there was that thing Boris announced yesterday of, you know, the 95% mortgages and stuff, which was like a state-backed guarantee, I think. Yeah, which would be good for house builders, probably. So it's all quite a murky muddle, really. And I guess, like with INL, Inland, the obvious thing to do is just look at the sideways range it's in. And when it breaks higher, which I think was something like 55p or 60p, when it breaks out, that's when it's telling you things are changing.
I've always liked the look of Inland, and I held it for a while back, many, many years ago, and I ended up selling out relatively early of that, and far too early. And one of the reasons I did that was because the board at the time, probably still now, were paying themselves a ridiculous amount for what was a very, very small cap at the time.
Yeah.
And I sold out. But if I remember rightly, the more brownfield sites used to get a lot of MOD land and property, and then, you know, refurbish, redo, you know, flatten and build really nice estates on them. So that is one where they tend to get their land a bit cheaper than most others. It's always been relatively steady. It's one definitely to keep an eye on.
But like one thing I picked up on UANC, I think it was on that one, they were saying that one of the problems they're having is that because of COVID-19 and social distancing and whatever, the productivity of planning departments in councils and stuff has really dropped off a cliff. So they're much slower at putting the land permissions through, which obviously is another wrinkle in the many wrinkles of the whole sorry saga.
Yeah, I think one of the government strategies, though, Pete, is for a lot of that planning / all the stuff to do with property, including conveyances, to be pushed more and more online. And I think I think that's going to be accelerated going forward. It's not going to be a case of waiting for a man or a woman at the planning office to do stuff in the next 2 or 3 or 4 years. It's going to be a case of, okay, they're going to be assisted with tech to speed these things up. Otherwise, you sat there with a person either working from home in the next 3 or 4 to 6 months, or working in the office with a pile of stuff stacking up there, looking at the pile going, oh, I can't face it today. So I think there's going to be, you're going to have to look at ways to assist that digitally.
I was watching something, I think it might have been Politics Live or something, in recent days, and one of the things that's come out a lot lately is this, that, you know, I think it's driven by Dominic Cummings, I think he's got his fingerprints all over it, but it's this idea that the civil service, the machinery of government, is very poor at delivering, and one of the reasons that this government is struggling, part of it is their own incompetence, obviously, but part of it is just that the whole machinery of government is just not very good at delivering things. It's almost like it's got sort of like ignored and hollowed out and whatever over many years, and it's sort of been denuded and denuded. And it isn't using IT effectively. And I think there's going to be this push to get more IT and tech and stuff into the civil service and to make it more efficient. But we're talking about, you know, this takes years and years and years, doesn't it? I mean, it's not something that happens overnight, but it, you know, it's certainly a theme to keep your eyes open for, I think. Things like, is it Panoply Holdings, TPX?
Yep.
I think that's one, isn't it? I don't really know much about that. But that seems to be a company, a fairly small company that does stuff in the government, you know, tech space, or IT tech space, that might be worth a look to try and catch that theme.
There are quite a few stocks out there, Pete, that you can catch a theme with regards to where the government's going to be pushing towards digital. And the important part of it is that you've got to watch the ones that actually benefit the larger sort of departmental concerns. And we've seen, you know, quite a few companies go into, for instance, the NHS, and it simply hasn't worked, or hasn't worked as well as it could do. I think it's Serco that are involved in the track and trace system at the minute. And, you know, that hasn't really got off to a really good start. Hopefully it will do in time. So, you know, you've got to watch what they not just jump on the fact X has won the contract, but look and see how that contract works out and how that work develops over a space of time, because if it goes well from the beginning, great, but you've got to see how it goes over a longer period of time rather than just the first 2 weeks or the first 3 months, because if it goes well over the longer term, then they'll get a subsequent contract somewhere else, some of these software companies and software as a service companies, AI and machine learning companies. That's what tends to happen. So it's definitely a theme to like you say, to keep an eye on.
Serco, which I think is SRP, the code, and Capita, CPI, are very much in that sort of big outsourcing thing, which used to be a massive, you know, massive popular theme 10 years ago, but sort of fell into disrepute. And of course, one of the problems with them is that they do so many things. And after the fiasco with Carillion and stuff like that, they've sort of had a bad name, haven't they? Bad press. But if you can find smaller ones, because there's companies like iDocs, isn't there? I can't remember much about that, but I think that does a lot in government, doesn't it? That's a smaller company. And there's obviously a lot in the defence space. Is it Cohort, CHRT, I think is one of them, that do a lot of IT work, you know, for Ministry of Defence, and it's very specialised, very niche. And I think a lot of those are quite interesting. But you've got to find them, obviously.
You've got to find them, yeah. The NHS one, I think, is EMIS, that's done significantly well. I felt it was overpriced when it IPO'd, and it's just gone from strength to strength. So that's done well over a long period of time, and continues to do reasonably well. So that's another one in that sort of space regarding government contracts and all the rest of it.
And that is literally EMIS, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it does the patient sort of software. So when I order repeat prescriptions, I do it through their system. I quite like EMIS. I think it's a nice little steady eddy for the future sort of thing.
Yeah,
I think you get about 3% dividend or a little bit less, but it's thing is, it's well embedded in the NHS.
It is
very difficult to be kicked out because so many people like me, so many patients use it, and it's quite difficult to switch to a different supplier.
Yeah, so the share price was down at £3-ish back in August 2010.
Yeah.
And it went up to £12.50 last year, and it's sitting at £10.64 now. So it's nice, steady, reasonable looking chart, and it's still got room for growth there. It's an AIM stock, sub £700 million market cap, so it's still doing all right there. Doing okay.
Yeah, I think it's been doing well. What's your thoughts on the overall markets then? How do you feel about it all at the moment?
It's a difficult one, Pete. You know, we're still trapped. I nearly said strapped then. That's a whole different podcast.
That's our racy version.
We're still trapped in that 5,800, 6,000 sort of zone, and we don't seem to be able to get out of it. And we finished today at 5,946, and the market's desperate to get out of this, you know, this little zone, really.
Mm.
And we keep getting moments of it, and of course we had the issue of President Trump becoming ill, going into hospital, coming out of hospital. So it's been a bit erratic.
What was that all about?
I think we best just skip that, Pete. I think at some point or other, when history goes down, the truth will be revealed as to what all that's about.
It seems like everybody who works in the White House is infected with COVID-19.
Well, I think unfortunately they have gone down a road of not taking the situation seriously enough. You know, in the White House, very few people were allegedly wearing masks. You know, when they were having their meetings, you know, that last big event that they had on, I don't know, was it a week and a half before he became infected? Lots of them attended that and didn't wear masks. I think at the last count, there was 37 people associated with either that event or the White House that have gone down now with COVID infections, including the president.
So
we will see what comes of it. My concern, obviously, is that they've gone elsewhere with lots of other people to lots of other meetings, and it's how many people have cross infected other people regarding that in America. So it's a biggie, mate. You know.
Well, the thing is, it sort of like played havoc with the markets the other day because. I had at the moment, I've got a fairly big short position on the FTSE 100. Yeah, I'm about 35% hedged effectively against my long portfolio. Now, I did have a fairly small S&P 500 short, and that was looking to be the right sort of positioning, you know, a week ago or whatever. But I got a sense that the US markets wanted to turn up again. And I got that real sense over last week. And I thought, I'm not really happy with this short position. I think I'm going to need to take it off soon. So I was sort of looking for that, looking for the triggers. And the NASDAQ, you know, I think it gave a 1321 EMA, 1321 day EMA cross, which is one of the big things for me. But not only that, the NASDAQ has been so bullish lately. I think fighting the NASDAQ on the short side is going to hurt. So as soon as I saw that had happened and I was looking at the S&P, I thought, right, I'm not having this anymore. I'm just taking it off. And I took it off and took a small loss. I think it was like 0.6% of my portfolio. Needless to say, straight away, Trump does his I've got COVID-19 routine and I'm going to flake and whatever. And it all goes completely bonkers. The market's tanked. I'm like, oh, no, I don't believe it. I just closed it like just before it tanked. But, you know, today it's back up again. And I think the US markets are actually looking quite perky. And, you know, I'm quite happy I closed that short.
The US markets are going to continue to be ultra volatile, Pete, seriously volatile. And every single sort of issue between now and November 3rd, right, is going to make that market move up and down. At, you know, you're looking at the markets moving on average, Pete, something like 500 to 700 points on the Dow, you know, to 1,000 points in one session, mate.
Big moves, isn't it?
You know what I mean? These are big moves, and it's almost like the computers are going, you know, absolutely haywire on that news, and it's like woo, and people don't know what to do, so they're actually sitting there with their hands tied, or trying to trade, pressing that sell button or the buy button, depending on the news. And as I said to you before, we're heading into this election, and President Trump wants the market to be positive, you know, wants it nearer to 29,000 on the Dow, 28,000 and so on and so forth, rather than 26, 25, because he wants to be seeing the markets to be as high as they possibly can be. So he's got that positivity towards him. And you touched on something which you've read somewhere about the markets being higher, that the incumbent usually wins, didn't you, last podcast?
Oh, yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, it was, I can't remember the details of it, but it was along those lines, wasn't it, that a strong stock market tends to help the incumbent.
Yeah, so irrespective of what's been happening regarding, you know, the stock splits of where are we? Apple and Tesla. The NASDAQ over the past month is now up 1.83%, Pete. You know, over the past month. And year to date, it's up still 26%, Pete.
Oh, it's been incredible, the NASDAQ.
Yeah. So it's still doing exceptionally, exceptionally well.
But I think that's one of the keys to US market. The bottom line is tech is still looking pretty bullish to me, and it's just not a good idea to fight it. And if you're short on the S&P like I was, then you know you've got a big tech weighting in the S&P now. I think it's up to like, I don't know, 25% or something, so it has a really big influence.
At the moment the S&P is up 1.4%. Over the past 5 days it's up 1.36%. Over the past month it's up 0.28%, and It's going to continue to be pushed, Pete. And if
I found September amazing, because September is traditionally the worst month. Yeah, I actually gained something like 3.2% or something on my portfolio. It was a good month. So it's weird how these things go, isn't it?
And it's about the stocks that you're in, Pete. We keep banging on about, be selective about the stocks that you're in. There's certain stocks that will not do well during this period of time, because, you know, if you're in the hospitality business or you're sitting in banks right now, you're not going to do well. You know, they're going to have their moment of this week will go up because of this, that and the other, but overall they're not going to do very well, so you're best staying away from them. And we've seen the classic situation where, you know, people were buying and being told to buy Cineworld, Pete, right? Back in March, April. It's a bargain now. And the share price, you know, moved significantly accordingly, because lots of people were saying buy Cineworld, and look what's happened this week. You know, they're basically closing most of the cinemas, you know, in a couple of weeks' time.
Well, I feel a little bit sorry for Cine shareholders, in the sense that in the last crisis in 2008-09, they held up really well. They turned out to be a very defensive stock. But since that, it's got so laden with debt because it bought Regal Cinemas in America and bought loads of other stuff. It's so loaded with debt. And then obviously with this problem on top of it, I mean, it's the poor thing's just been crushed.
The thing, Pete, last time, the last recession, right? We were able and everyone was able to go out, right? So regardless of the recession and people being depressed and the outlet was to go out to the pub, to go out with your mates, to go out and watch a decent film with your partner and your friends and whoever you wanted to, or on your own, and go and enjoy a good film.
Mm.
Yeah? And since the last recession, what's happened? You've also got streaming, Pete. You've got kids and younger people who don't watch any TV, don't go to the cinema, and just watch everything on their laptop or their phones. Yeah? And what do? They go and buy they make a massive acquisition, yeah, with a view to this is the future. We're going to make sure we've got all of these cinemas, and we're going to dominate and monopolise the cinema industry. Yeah. And wallop, the share price has gone in the past 2 years from, I don't know what. I'll have to have a look. Let me just have a quick look.
It's been spanked, hasn't it?
It's been absolutely spanked. I mean, it's at 27 pence now, right, today.
27.
And where are we? 2017, it was £3.24. April last year, it was £3.20. And December, it was £2. So it's had a horrible, horrible time, mate. And right now, you know, you're looking at 7,000 people losing their jobs, potentially. Because of, I don't want to say company mismanagement, but, you know, the whole point of having a CEO, CFO and NEDs, right, and you're paying them accordingly, is to look out for what's going on elsewhere. And no one could have foreseen COVID-19. But who was saying that this merger, huge mega merger, was a mistake, given the fact that streaming was the way that things were going forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? The COVID situation was very difficult to foresee in terms of what it's actually meant in detail. But it was certainly easy to see that if you load the company with debt, don't be surprised if you have a problem, because we've seen it so often. You know, it's the classic thing, isn't it, that indebted companies are nearly always going to be bad news for you. And it also stresses this point as investors, how important it is to have a diverse portfolio. You know, if you held Cine in a diverse portfolio with 25 other stocks, you know, you're probably up this year and doing all right, even though you have one that's done really quite badly. And that's the key with diversification. It can really save your backside sometimes.
Absolutely. I mean, it's down 87% at the moment, Pete, year to date, Cineworld. March lows were around the 21 pence, 20 pence sort of area. And then, you know, we were looking to do reasonably well during the summer. Lots of people were talking the stock up, and it hit nearly a pound in June. And now it's ebbed and flowed, and now it's down to 27 pence. And, you know, for somebody, you know, if it survives at some point or other, and in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years time, you can deal with the debt, and they come back next year and the cinemas open and films start to be produced again, could be a bargain for somebody. But you'd have to be very, very patient, and you'd have to be concerned that there is a risk that potentially this level of debt can't be repaid and the banks just pull the plug.
It's a lot of ifs there.
Or a predator comes in and says, yeah, we'll pay for 35 pence for that, but yeah, you're loaded up at £1 or £2, you never get your return again.
It's a lot of ifs, mate. And one something I picked up on, they were interviewing Mookie, you know, the guy who's the CEO, Mookie Gradlinger or something. And one of the things I picked up I hadn't realised was that apparently cinemas are seen by the film production companies, you know, like Warner Brothers or whoever. They see it as advertising because it's like they can create a splash. So you have a launch in Leicester Square, you have a big splash that the new Bond film's coming out, it gets a buzz going, everyone's excited to go and see it. That then helps streaming sales and all the other sales that come from other routes. What's quite interesting that it is more of a marketing device than oh yeah, we want to show it in cinema screens.
Yeah, and obviously that's important. It's a cross pollination of all the advertising, isn't it? Get as many different streams.
Well, this thing, I mean, the problem that Cineworld has got is basically that the Bond film isn't being launched. Yeah. When Tenet when the film Tenet was launched, that really helped them because it was a blockbuster movie and it had a lot of publicity, and it helped them once they were able to open up after lockdown. But since that, there just aren't the blockbuster movies that are going to drag people in to see things. And without that excitement of the blockbuster, you know, obviously cinemas are finding it tough. You can only show Casablanca so many times. You know, people just get bored with it.
Casablanca. I mean, the issue, Pete, is, you know, it's that social distance thing, isn't it? You know, and I think the great thing about, you know, going to see a film was that atmosphere. It's like going to the football. Yeah. It's the atmosphere when you hear that that sharp intake of breath of yeah. another 100 people surrounding you because you've all seen the same thing at the same time. It's like you're all like, you know, I don't think you get that at home as much when there's just you and one other or two other people watching the film.
Well, it's you and your pet hamster. It's not, you're not going to get much unless it's like, you know, a sort of animal film or something.
No, so I sincerely hope that the industry is able to continue and also thrive, because we need this, Pete. We need these social outlets, you know, and we're social animals. We need to have a way to do things in a way that enables us to share. Yeah, and that's what it's about. You know, live concerts, Pete. I know, because we used to talk about this a lot. You used to love
I was always going to concerts. Yeah, you know? Yeah, but I mean, that it's just such a shame. Mate, something we touched on just now that I wouldn't mind covering very quickly, because our mate Henry Viola, he asked us a question about it and said, could we just talk about it on the podcast? Was the idea of the big banks, and he specifically mentioned Barclays, BARC. Just wondering what your thoughts on those were, really.
Well, I'll tie them all in with banks per se, rather than talking specifically about Barclays.
Yeah, I think we should do that. Yeah.
I spoke to you about what happened, you know, earlier in the year and December, and I was speaking to somebody and they asked me about Lloyds, for instance, and I said, you know, you these are all different things. Have all these considered? Blah 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 blah, and eventually that person save themselves several hundred thousand pounds regarding that particular stock and selling out of Lloyd's early. And, you know, last time we spoke, I think it was at 30 pence, is now sub 30 pence.
Yeah.
We're essentially, Pete, and no one wants to talk about it, but the UK is in a recession, right? So what's a recession?
Time, yeah.
It's a temporary economic decline, right? And it's a falling GDP of two successive quarters. This situation started in March. We're now in September, October. That's two quarters. When we get to December, that's three quarters. Yeah? That's a recession we're in, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the banks are in a situation where they're not getting the same sort of revenues. They're not getting the same margins. Yeah? A lot of the smarter people are reducing their debts, paying off their mortgages. Yeah? They're not going out borrowing. Yeah? If they're buying houses or buying new cars, they're doing that with cash that they've got. So they're borrowing less, if not nothing at all. They're buying things in cash. So if you're buying a new car, you're not really looking to get yourself indebted, which invariably goes back to some bank at some stage or other, or an organisation that's borrowed from a bank. So less and less people are getting that going that way. And then you've got the online sort of situations where people are doing banking that way. And the big banks are shutting their branches, as we spoke about last time, right? Yeah. Because everything's going digital, everything's going tech, we're going towards a cashless society, all these different things. So where would you rather be? Would you rather be in a tech-related industry, fintech-related industry, yeah? Or would you rather invest in a bank, right? You'd rather invest in a bank, Pete. In a fintech-related entity, sorry, rather than a bank.
You talked yourself out of it there, mate.
Yeah, their time will come, Pete, but it's certainly not now.
No, that's how I feel about it. I mean, I hold HSBC, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I hold Standard Chartered Stan. And, you know, they've just been absolutely dismal. And they've been a great example how my diversification has helped me, because they've been absolute pigs. And the only reason that I even hold those is because I sort of feel I ought to have some diversity in my portfolio, which would include some exposure to banks. And, of course, they've got more of an Asia focus. But I was thinking about this earlier today because I remembered that Henry had asked us the question. And I was thinking, well, if you wanted to be in financial stuff, maybe you'd be better off in like stocks like Aviva, AV dot, which I hold, or maybe, I don't know, Prudential or Legal & General, you know, the sort of life insurer stroke insurance side of things. Maybe that's a better place to be. I mean, but none of them are like massively, hugely attractive places, are they really?
They're not, but the situation with the insurance companies, other than potentially the COVID-related payments they're going to have to give out, is that a lot of them, and we spoke about this regarding people not using their cars, Pete, is the fact that a lot of the insurance that's not related to COVID was significantly reduced, yeah? As a consequence of people not going out as much. So, you know, and they've got, you know, a significant amount of... some of them have got significant amounts of cash on the balance sheet, and some of them are looking to downsize and use more tech. So they're going to innovate more so, Pete. They're not going to be the whole staid, boring... When people think of insurance companies, they always think of bored, staid, boring companies.
Yeah.
And they're going to become quite, you know, innovative going forward, and that's going to enable them to be lean, keen machines going forward. I would sooner be in Legal & General, Aviva, Prue less so than Lloyd's or Barclays.
Oh, absolutely.
And the other stuff, Pete, is that they've still got other skeletons in their cupboards regarding, you know, all the other mispayments and misinformation and other things that have gone on. You know, we saw the PPI was the last big one, and I'm sure there's other skeletons that will come out that will cost these banks significantly going forward.
HSBA got hit, you know, week ago or so because of money laundering things, which was fairly much old news, but it again impacted the share price and just gives this sort of negativity around it, which isn't going to help. One that might be worth thinking about, but again, I think with any of these things, you just don't want to be rushing. I mean, they're the kind of stocks where you've got to look at the charts, and if the chart is in a downtrend, just keep away from it. There's no point buying it. If the chart has been in a downtrend, now it's going sideways, wait for it to break out of the sideways range and start moving up. There's just no point buying it before that, unless you're a range trader, which is a completely different thing. One that was mentioned as a main tip in Investors Chronicle, I think last week, was Virgin Money, VMUK. What was interesting about this one was that even if you... Now, I've got to try and remember the maths of it. Basically, it was something like a 70% discount to net asset value. And it was even if you just took the surplus capital they've got, yes, surplus to requirements in terms of what the FCA, the regulator, stipulates they should have, the surplus cash they have is actually more than the market cap of VMUK.
Very interesting, Pete. Very interesting. Yeah.
So I thought that was, you know, I mean, it is risky, you know. I mean, but the other thing that was interesting, I mean, Investors Chronicle used to do like 4 tips every week, yeah? And the good thing about them is that you should never buy an Investors Chronicle tip just because you've read it, do you know what I mean? But what you should do is use them as a potential source and a way to learn things about the companies. And so they used to do like 4 of these a week plus a fund tip, yeah, and each would have a page. But what they've started doing lately, and I really like this and I hope they stick with it, is that they've started just doing 2 tips, but they're doing 2 pages on each, so it's more in depth. And I think that's a really good move, and I hope they keep that going.
That might be a very good thing to do, Pete. But I want to go back, if I may, to the banks. And
go where you want, mate. Go where you want. As you know, this is totally unscripted, and we've got very loose crib sheet.
I think the interesting thing is that people keep talking about discounts to book value when it comes to banks.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they need to find another metric to measure what is deep value regarding these banks. Because, you know, we've talked loads of times about Metro being a huge discount to book value.
A huge discount to reality.
Why, and I keep saying this, you know, that the banking industry is going through a massive, significant change, right? These discounts to book value will continue to be significant. The first bank to get back to full book value, yeah, will be something of heralded, yeah, because they're having to structurally change, Pete, and they're competing against these nimble little fintech orientated online digitally enhanced banks that are nibbling away at them, right? So you can talk about ASOS and Boohoo, and you talk about Starling and others. That's what's going on in the finance industry. The Boohoos and the ASOSes are there nibbling away at said companies, yeah, at these banks, and they've been ignoring these companies. And we saw what happened to Boohoo and ASOS. They grow and grow and grow in size. Most of these nimble little companies are not listed, Pete. Yeah. So what happens to Lloyds? What happens to Barclays? What happens to HSBC, Standard Life, Standard Bank, etc.? They decrease, and their discount to book value remains.
Yeah, I mean that's a really good point. Something else, just mentioned quickly on VM UK. I don't hold VM UK. Something just mentioned quickly is that in that Investors Chronicle article, they actually reckon that VM UK has used a more conservative, if you like, more stricter scenario planning than many of the other banks have. So in fact, they're probably understating their assets, and they've still got like this massive discount to assets that they're probably understating. So it's, I mean, the other thing that comes into assets, obviously, is that it could attract takeovers, because other entities will be looking at, and particularly private equity, and thinking, well, hang on, there's just an immense discount there. That just isn't right.
And that's why you've got to look beneath what's on the top of the, you know, top of the bonnet, Pete, and look at where the debts are and where the red flags are and where the next big problem may come, because that discount might be, you know, something of an anomaly. But when you look at all the different issues that could come its way, you know, like HSBC, that money might be needed rather quickly to deal with all the litigation that might come its way, you know?
Exactly.
Before we go any further, I want to touch on a stock today that I hold, and has been absolutely smashed to smithereens today.
Oh no!
And I hope that
I don't like the sound of that.
No. It's Pete. You've got, as I said this to you before, and I've said this to people all the time. When you're invested in a high risk stock, and it does supremely well, you know, invariably, if something goes wrong along the way, then it's going to get spanked. This is part and parcel of investing. And if you're trading, and you're trading on binary events or RNSs or the half year, the full year, or something coming out regarding what this particular company is doing, and then the information is not as good as the market's expecting, what happens is the company gets spanked. You have to take this, the good and the bad and the indifferent, if you're going to be an investor. And if you're going to be a trader, you know, trading for the next day and the next day and the next day, then you're going to get hurt, right? So the company I spoke about a little while ago was 4D Pharma.
Oh, yeah, D-D-D-D.
Yeah, ticker symbol, 4Ds.
Yeah.
And the expectation was on the Blortex IBS data, the top-line results are going to be absolutely smashing. And today they released that finally. And the data is good, but not blockbuster good, okay? So the efficacy side of it was 24-25% above the placebo, which it's not great. And the company that's out there at the minute that's got a significant sort of push on the IBS side had an efficacy of, I think it was 52 or 54. So it's far higher than 4Ds. Yeah.
So, can we just clarify, because I'm not that up to speed on 4D. Right. So 4D has got a drug, has it? Or a drug in
trial? It's working on a drug for IBS amongst another 16 lines of stuff that they're looking at across COVID, across COPD, across rare diseases and blah, blah, blah. And this one, particular so one, was for
irritable
IBS.
Irritable bowel syndrome.
IBS.
Yeah.
So this was the phase two, and it came out below what most people expected. So a lot of people were I bought into this at 36 pence. It was at £1.80 last week, Pete. That's how far people had jumped on the bandwagon and were making rallying cries regarding this stock. Mm. And the idea behind this was, if this has come out today, or whichever day it came out today, and it was, you know, efficacy of 46, 50 maybe, or something high, the share price would have jumped from 160-ish, as it was today, to £2, £2.40 and more. And the momentum would have continued, and more people would have bought this stock. So the people that were trading the stock and investing in the stock had high expectations, and some only bought into this stock at £1.20, £1.40, £1.60 even, right?
Yeah.
Today, the stock ebbed and flowed with various people saying various different things about the stock, and it closed down 37%, Pete, and finished at 109.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So what happens, you said to me about somebody talking about clustering, what happens when you've got a significant number of investors and a significant number of traders waiting for a piece of news, and then the news is not quite as good as the market would like, is you get that trickle effect in the morning where people are saying, it's the news isn't as bad as it seems, or it's better than, you know, it's better than this and better than that. Eventually, those traders and those short-term investors that were looking for a pop from 160 to 180 to £2 to £2.50 all rush for the exits, right? So as a consequence today, that stock is down 37%, Pete, and it's down at 109, having been 180 last week. So those that were happy to pay 160 for it were happy to sell today at £1.10, £1.50 and a £1.20. Take the loss and run. But this company has got significant pipeline of other drugs and other things that they're looking at. So I'm still in the stock. I haven't sold any today. Yeah. And I'm still in profit in the stock. And people that are looking at this stock or going to look at it and think it's a bargain need to do their research in the stock and have a view on the stock beyond the next set of results or the next year, and look beyond what it's going to do in the next 2 or 3 years.
So what's your sort of sense with the, I mean, you're going to hold your position, are you? Is that what you're thinking
yes,
at the moment?
Yes.
And what's your sort of like, are you thinking, well, it will recover in 6 months, or have you got any expectation, or are you just like, well, I'm going to stick with it and we'll see what happens? But what's your sort of gut feel?
I'm looking, Pete, at the immunology and the gastrointestinal and the respiratory and everything else that they do regarding all the different rare diseases that they're working
on.
Right? It's almost like looking at a company and looking at its potential and what it can do beyond October 2020 and looking at what it could do between 2021, 22, 23, 24. And that's the reason why I invest in these companies that are off the radar. I bought it off the radar at 36 pence, right? Not that many people were interested in it.
Yeah.
It came out with some data last month. Lots of people wanted to buy it in August and September, and then it moved all the way up to 130, 140, and lots of people were jumping on the bandwagon. And all the news that was there was saying that these results were going to be significant. They were good, but not significant and not blockbuster. Hence the reason why a lot of people that were short-termist on the stock have bailed, right? I don't know whether this is an opportunity or whether or not the share price will go even lower than 109, yeah? But I'm looking at all the different stuff that they're in, and all the possibilities that it has going forward, and the fact that this company has potential. I'm taking my stance on it. Everyone has to make their own mind up about it, Pete.
And the thing is, you can change your stance anyway. It might be in 6 months, a year. You think, well, actually, I've reflected on it, and the key thing that you've said to me that really stands out there is that you basically are saying to me that you bought at 36p and you bought it as a long term investor with a long term view. The fact that it went mental in the short term and shot up is like an added bonus. But of course, now a bit of the heat's come out of it. But you still feel it's something for the long term. You're happy to hold it. And I take it you haven't got like a massive position in it, because I know that you're careful with your position sizing, which is always the thing, isn't it? When you've got something really speculative and risky, don't put loads of money in it. Just keep it as a sensible part of your portfolio.
It was a sensible part of my portfolio, Pete, until it went up fivefold, right?
Yeah. Well, and then you have the decision, do I top slice? You know, you've got to make decisions all the time, haven't you?
I'm making decisions all the time, Pete. And the beauty of having a long-term view on a company is that these things happen. Hello? You've got to take the good and bad with it.
So we've gone then, mate. We had the old quiet moment. I'm thinking, oh no, the broadband's gone.
No, not
we're
yet.
We're good. I got a blue light here, mate, if that means anything.
not a red light,
I will add, you know, by the way.
No, we don't want one of them, Pete. But the thing with all the stocks that I do my deep research on, Pete, is that I'm looking for the good, the bad, and indifferent. There's good, with all things that are biotech or tech-related, at some point or other, there's going to be a hit, there's going to be a blip and all the rest of it. And I put out a brilliant almost an analogy of a tweet, right, earlier on today. And that was about ITM, right? And that sat there and ebbed and flowed and up and down and all the rest of it and didn't really go very far for ages, right? Yeah. And now it's sitting back up at £3, having been as high as £3.60. But that was a stock I bought at 23 pence, Pete.
Fantastic.
But it took 6 years for it to get to £3.60 odd.
Yeah, but it's like, it's worth waiting 6 years when you get that kind of jump.
Well, the difficulty is, Pete, I'm not a trader, right? So to get something that goes up for you, yeah, 1,000%, right, or 1,500%, how many trades have I got to do at 15% for that?
Oh, yeah.
I've got to do 100 trades and get 100 trades right.
Yeah.
I'd rather just get one piece of research right.
Get one right.
And sit and wait.
Yeah.
And if it's right, I'm going to carry on running it for as best I possibly can. And sometimes I'll top slice and reduce the position accordingly. You know, and if it doesn't work out, you know, like, you know, what's the most recent one? Probably Hurricane Energy, which didn't work out for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Right? I then go, I got it wrong. And I sell it and I move on. You've got to learn to take the good and the bad. And when you're wrong, you're wrong. Yeah?
Yeah. Mate, you sort of hinted at it just now. One of the geezers who follows us on Twitter, which his handle is at VSIHV, he asked us, he says there's a lot of FinTwit, you know, finance people on Twitter who are clustering in the same stocks and talk about the same stocks. And he says, is that a problem? What's your sort of thoughts on that?
It's certainly a problem, Pete, when the stock goes pear-shaped, as what happened today with 4D, yeah.
So what you're saying then is that, like, some investors, traders on Twitter who seem to be pretty good, they might have been talking about 4D, and then lots of other people won't have bothered with all that hard work around research and stuff. They will have just bundled in and bought 4D because everyone else is buying 4D, and you end up with all these people in this fairly illiquid small stock. And then, as you say, when something goes wrong, everyone runs for the exits and it just hammers the price because there's no liquidity in it. That is
absolutely it, Pete. So you've seen the situation, right, with a, you know, I'll give a couple of examples, right?
Yeah.
Off the top of my head, Games Workshop. Okay. Boohoo. Yeah. Burford. Right. AAZ. Right. Those are companies right now which a load of the FinTwit, right, and a load of the people on Twitter and social media are all in, right?
Yeah.
And they've invariably performed exceptionally well, right? And then when something goes wrong, these share prices have halved or fallen by a third at one stage or another. Some of them have recovered in the likes of Games Workshop, that's recovered, yeah? But somebody like AAZ right now are at the lower reaches of where the shares have been in the past 12 months. Yeah? Games Workshop, you said it's high. Boohoo is in the middle sort of range, but it's still done significantly well. So if you saw what happened in the summer regarding Boohoo, Pete, it halved nearly.
Oh, well, I was holding it, mate. I mean, this was part of the reason that my portfolio as a whole went into profit for the year, you know, 2 months ago or something. And I was like really happy and thinking, oh, this is good. Of course, then I got hit by Boohoo, which was probably my biggest position. And straight away, I'm like down 6% or something. It absolutely murdered me. But fortunately, part of the reason I'm back in the money again is because Boo has recovered. And I'm so pleased that I stayed calm, kept my bottle and stuck with it. But it was testing at times, I must say.
If you're one of the pieces of research that I do, right, is I'm looking for stocks that are in certain niches that potentially could do well. And part of the research that I do is I'm looking on social media and I'm looking at how many people are talking about this stock, right? And if I see a stupid amount of tweets regarding that particular stock, and I haven't got the conviction for that particular stock that I should have, that will be something that will put me off. That will be not going there. And especially if it's that small, tiny AIM stock, I won't go anywhere near it, Pete.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good point. I mean, we mentioned Boohoo and Games Workshop in that bunch. I don't really know much about AAZ. But on those first two, I would say they're a bit more liquid than a lot of the AIM more junky stuff is, which is really liquid.
And Pete, let me interrupt you. Pete, yeah. it doesn't matter regarding liquidity, right? When you've got a FTSE All Share 350, whatever sort of, you know, 100, 200, 500, 1 billion pounds market cap company, when everyone's rushing for the exit, including the institutions, yeah. Pete, yeah. Remember Brexit when Persimmon was, you know, down 40, 50%?
Yeah.
Yeah? You've had that slow trickle regarding Royal Dutch Shell, Pete. Look at this, the share price is down 50, 60%.
Oh,
sometimes the people trickling out the exit are as dangerous, with all of them being in the stock for pensions, as it is people in one day going out 30, 40%. And we saw that with Fevertree, you know, halving. So the difficulty you've got is looking to see how many people are in this stock, how many institutions are in this stock. And sometimes when the share price is doing well and the company's producing it and the results are going well and it's smashing expectations, it's brilliant that everyone's in that stock. Why? Because other people will start to buy that stock as well. But when the going's bad, it accelerates downside and it really can hurt you. So beware of which stocks you're picking regarding how volatile will this stock be if the results don't go to plan.
Because I think there's an interesting point here that's worth mentioning as well, is that, you know, we're talking about the sellers running for the exit. Part of the problem, in fact, is the holders. Because people like me with Boo held it and held firm, yeah, we weren't going nowhere. My shares, that I've got quite a few of, weren't in the liquidity pool that you could have been buying and selling from that pool on that given day. You know, my shares are sat to one side and loads of other people's shares. So in a way, if you've got a stock that's got lots of long-term holders in, that in itself is a problem, because a lot of them won't be selling. You won't be getting any liquidity.
Absolutely.
It's so multifaceted, this stuff. You know, the mechanics of how trades work and markets work and the buys and sells work and the people who are holding. I mean, it's so complicated and so multifaceted. It's quite mad, really, when you think about it. I think a lot of people don't understand that at all.
It is, and that's the reason why, Pete, and that's quite a good segue to something I wanted to mention.
Yeah, go on.
The reason why you have to do more research and you have to do more reading, and you almost have to go away and look at how you can improve your investing or your trading, right? There's a really, really good friend of mine. He's called Alan Penhallow, and he's putting together a virtual trading course, Pete, for private, he calls them private own risk investors. And it's an insight into the hazards of trading, Pete.
Okay.
You've got this fantastic guy called Cormac Butler, who's going to be the trainer that's going to deliver that course. And he's worked with various large banks, including the Bank of England, the Irish Bank, and all the rest of it. And he's got a whole swathe of experience, and he's usually in the papers when things are going wrong with banks, and he investigates the banks. So if anybody wants to invest in banks, probably speak to Cormac. He'll probably tell you not to do that.
Is he on Twitter or anything?
Alan Penhallow isn't. Cormac Butler is. I'll find the Twitter handle and I'll add it to the write-up that I do. But this particular course, it's an open course date. It's the 28th of October. It's a virtual learning course, very in-depth. The price is £580. Description is designed to take you through the basics of DIY investing, from selecting a broker to dealing with the tax advantages of organizing your own pension investment strategy. We focus on helping you out to set your investment objectives, develop strategies for short-term and long-term investments, and so on and so forth. So yeah, all tax, capital gains, and all the rest of it. And yeah, so the website is www.penassco.co.uk, penassco.co.uk, and Alan Penhallow is going to be doing sorting that course out. And the great thing about that particular course I like about it as well is that he'll be doing some things on cognitive bias. Always important to look at the psychology and rear view mirror investing, fear, greed, and contrarian versus technical trading.
Yeah. Do you have any commercial relationship with him, or just because he's a mate or whatever?
I've been working on and doing various forums covering the London Economist, property guys, and all the rest of it. And Alan's got about 40 years experience investing and working across the city. And I met with him about a year ago, and he's a phenomenal guy.
Okay.
And he used to do these for corporates. So all the big banks and all the institutions that we speak about, he used to do the training for them, for the people that needed to go on various courses at different levels.
Yeah.
So I've been speaking with him and meeting with him and another 30, 40, 50 individuals, male and female, that work across the city for the past 2 or 3 years. And this is something that he's developed from doing it face-to-face, and now he's doing it online. So there's no commercial relationship. I'm just giving a shout-out regarding that course. Because I think with lots of people wanting to learn how to invest and trade, Pete, it's better to get this trading training from the experts that have done it for the experts in the city. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So that's why I mentioned it, because I don't think these courses at this sort of level come very often. You've usually got to be registered or working in a large corporate entity to get access to a course of this sort of level.
Oh, yeah. Wait, can I mention a couple of stocks quickly? I know we're running tight on time. We've been going an hour. One I hold quickly, Diversified Gas and Oil Company, DGOC. Had some massive news this week, and I doubt people have realised the significance. Basically, they've done an agreement with Oaktree Capital, where Oaktree Capital are going to put up $1 billion over the next 3 years, and it will be to put with money that DGOC come up with themselves, yeah? So DGOC might borrow it, or they might have it, or whatever. And they are going to be looking at acquisitions of $200 million upwards. I mean, DGOC have been saying for a while that this environment of low oil prices and low gas prices, natural gas prices, is absolutely ideal for them to pick up desperate sellers, selling really good assets. So, and the thing I found with DGOC, having held it maybe 3 years now since IPO, it tends to jump when there's an acquisition, because they tend to be earnings enhancing every time they do it. So that's certainly one to keep your eye on. A stock that I think looks really interesting, which I think I mentioned on a podcast a few weeks ago, BAR, which is Brand Architects. It's a really weird spelling, so anyway, but it's BAR. It used to be Swallowfield, yeah, which did like cosmetics, basically. Now, what's interesting about BAR, apart from the fact that Simon Thompson covers them, yeah, and they're one of his bargain shares, it's got all of the cosmetics ingredients, right? It's got all the ingredients of a really good recovery play, because the market cap is about 22 million. It's got something like 18 million of cash. Now, it really reminds me of what happened with MPAC. You've got new management in, and it's, you know, I can see a situation where they turn this around and make it really good. I don't hold it, but it's certainly one that I've been looking at, and I think, you know, I think it could be a good one. So just highlighting it, really. A couple of other ones, just to mention quickly. There was a company called Calnex, C-A-L-N-E-X, which is code CLX, which does network testing, and it IPO'd a couple of days ago at 48p. Now, I don't know anything about it, but I do know that network testing is quite an interesting area. So that might be worth looking into, but that's all I know.
Pete, just one sec. Does that one sit into, because we've been asked questions in the past about 5G online, all the rest of it. Would they be involved in any of that?
I really don't know, but I suspect it might be.
Okay, so that's probably one we need to have a look at then, research it a bit more.
Yeah, I think it's one, you know. The other one to mention quickly is a company called Phonex, F-O-N-E-X, which is code F-N-X. I think it's going to, I might have the date wrong, but I think it said 12th of October, it's going to IPO. And that one reminds me of Bango, B-G-O, which I do hold, and also of Boku, B-O-K-U. as it does direct carrier billing. So that might be worth a look.
Okie dokie. Excellent, mate. Excellent.
Something else I'll just mention quickly, not a stock. One of the guys who follows us, great guy, Scott Parker, he had a question for us about how we find ideas. We ain't going to have time on this podcast, but we will cover it, Scott. Yeah, it will be done.
Cool. Right, everyone. Pete and I have been here long enough. We want to thank you all for listening to us and continuing to subscribe.
Thank you.
On Google Podcasts and Spotify and iTunes and Audio Boom and SoundCloud and Overcast. So thank you all for listening and subscribing to this podcast and keeping it on your watch list and listening list. So thank you all for your continued support, and thank you all.
Thank
if you're listening for the first time, you just found Pete and I, please subscribe. And you can find us also on our Twitter handles at Conkers3 and at Wheelie Dealer on Twitter. And all we're asking is that you stay safe, stay healthy, and see us again in 2 weeks' time. And in the meantime, any feedback you want to share with us, please do so on the various platforms, and also on Twitter, where we are more likely than not to reply. And you know, thank you for your continued questions as well. We appreciate that as well. Pete, definitely. Anything you want to close with?
No, that's brilliant. I mean, the only other thing to mention quickly is that, you know, we're sponsored by SharePad. There is a ShearPad deal, ShareScope deal, where you get a month free if you sign up through us. If you go to my website or Peter's website, there's adverts all over it. Just click one and you can sign up. Job done.
Yeah, and I think regarding the volatility that we spoke about regarding the markets, opportunities are being thrown up every single day. So having a great platform where you can filter and check and get all the really up-to-date information regarding that particular stock that you may find yourself off the radar, it's a great source of you know, a rich resource for you, the ShearPad, ShareScope platform. So it's worth investigating. And if you can get a discount on it by going via our links, then why not? You know, so go for it.
Thank you. Good
stuff. All right, ladies and gents, take
care. Later.
Stay safe and God bless. We look forward to seeing you all very, very soon. Bye-bye for now.
Cheers.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast was brought to you in association with ShearPad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit shareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.